This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, our own Marjorie Cohn discusses the International Court of Justice's recent finding that Israel is plausibly committing genocide against Palestinians in Gaza.
I will discuss the six provisional measures or injunction that the World Court ordered Israel to carry out.
We're also joined by New York City Attorney Maria LaHood from the Center for Constitutional Rights.
She will discuss the lawsuit that CCR filed on behalf of Palestinians against Joe Biden, Antony Blinken, and Lloyd Austin for failure to prevent genocide and complicity in genocide on the part of Israel in Gaza.
Stay with us. I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
I am civil rights attorney Julie Hurwitz, a partner in the law firm of Goodman, Hurwitz & James, based in Detroit, Michigan, and a board member of the Michigan chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. On January 26th, the International Court of Justice, ICJ, or World Court, handed down a historic near-unanimous ruling in South Africa's case against Israel for its genocide against the Palestinian people in Gaza. More than 26,000 Palestinians have been killed and more than 65,000 injured by the Israeli occupying forces since Hamas's October 7th attacks. As well, more than 85% of the Palestinians in Gaza have been displaced. The World Court, in its ruling, concluded that South Africa presented a plausible case that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. The court held that the right of the Palestinians to be free from genocidal acts and South Africa's right as a party to the Genocide Convention to ensure Israel's compliance with the convention could be protected by six provisional measures in the form of an injunction, which the court ordered Israel to take. South Africa's Ministry of Foreign Affairs described the court's decision as a, quote, decisive victory for the international rule of law and a significant milestone in the search for justice for the Palestinian people, end quote. The Lawyers for Palestinian Human Rights called the ICJ's decision a, quote, much-needed light in the darkness, end quote, adding, and I quote, "It is a historic day for clearly recognizing the fundamental human rights of Palestinians, including their fundamental right to life, and an important vindication of the vital resort to law to uphold fundamental rights," end quote. Richard Falk, former UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Occupied Palestine Territory, said the ICJ's ruling, quote, "marks the greatest moment in the history of the court because it strengthens the claims of international law to be respected by all sovereign states, not just some," end quote. This is particularly significant in light of the recent ruling here in the United States in which the Federal District Court on January 31st dismissed a lawsuit against the U.S. for its complicity in Israel's genocide, despite agreeing that, quote, "it is plausible that Israel's conduct amounts to genocide," end quote. Our own co-host, Marjorie Cohn, is with us today to explain the decision of the ICJ and its ramifications. She is Dean of the People's Academy of International Law and a member of the Bureau of International Association of Democratic Lawyers. Marjorie is also Professor of Law Emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and former National President of the National Lawyers Guild. She has written several articles about Israel's genocidal campaign in Gaza for Truthout. Marjorie, welcome back to the interview chair on Law and Disorder.
Well, thanks for having me, Julie.
Marjorie, what did the ICJ conclude in its landmark decision?
Well, it was really stunning, Julie. The ICJ, or the World Court, concluded that South Africa had presented a plausible case that Israel is committing genocide. And in its ruling, the court said it is acutely aware of the extent of the human tragedy that's unfolding in the region, and it's deeply concerned about the continuing loss of life and human suffering. The court described the civilian population in Gaza as extremely vulnerable. It noted that tens of thousands of deaths and injuries and the destruction of homes, schools, medical facilities, other vital infrastructure, displacement was taking place on a massive scale. And the court also said that the operation is ongoing and that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had stated it will take many more long months. The court noted that at present, many Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have no access to the most basic foodstuffs, potable water, electricity, essential medicines, heating. And South Africa, in its presentation to the ICJ, said that it unequivocally condemned the targeting of civilians by Hamas and other Palestinian armed groups and the taking of hostages on 7 October, but no armed attack on a state's territory, no matter how serious, even an attack involving atrocity crimes, can provide any justification for or defense to genocide. South Africa said Israel has crossed this line.
And what was Israel's position in this case? You mentioned Benjamin Netanyahu's comment about how long this is going to take. What is their position in regard to what it did in advance of the ICJ's ruling to try to convince the court that it was not committing genocide?
Right. Well, Julie, Israel responded by placing responsibility squarely on Hamas for the situation in Gaza. Israel said that this is not a genocide case. If anyone was a victim of genocide, Israel was on October 7th when the Palestinian resistance forces allegedly killed 1,200 people. Israel said, let's not use genocide. Let's talk about international humanitarian law, which is basically war crimes. Of course, they are accusing Hamas of war crimes. Hamas is not part of this case. It's not a state party to the Genocide Convention. And not surprisingly, Julie, Israel rejected the decision of the World Court. Netanyahu called it outrageous. He characterized the charges of genocide as unfounded. And the National Security Minister labeled the ICJ anti-Semitic, which, of course, is what they pull out whenever anybody criticizes the policies of Israel, confusing and conflating anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. Not that the ICJ was anti-Zionist, but that's just a general comment. And also, the National Security Minister said, this court does not seek justice, but rather the persecution of the Jewish people. Decisions that endanger the continued existence of the State of Israel must not be listened to. Julie, even before the ICJ decision was announced, Israeli leaders were doing fancy footwork to try to contain the anticipated fallout and defend the idea that Israel had ordered increased humanitarian aid to Gaza. So in anticipation of the ICJ decision, Israel declassified more than 30 secret orders of government and military leaders that Israel says rebut South Africa's charge that it committed genocide in Gaza. Israel claims the documents actually show that its government attempted to reduce civilian casualties. These documents include summaries of cabinet meetings in late November, in which Netanyahu ordered supplies of aid, water, and fuel to be delivered to Gaza. And he told the government to determine whether they could establish hospitals to treat Palestinians in Gaza and even moor a hospital ship off the coast. another cabinet meeting, the minutes say that Netanyahu continually stressed the need to significantly increase humanitarian aid to Gaza. And another document said it is recommended to respond favorably to the request of the USA to enable the entry of fuel. It's interesting how they admitted that the USA has such, such power here. According to the New York Times, and I'm quoting now, the dossier is also highly curated and omits most wartime instructions given by the cabinet and the military. The available documents do not include orders from the first 10 days of the war when Israel blocked aid to Gaza and shut off access to the electricity and water it normally provides to the territory. Now, William Shabas, who's an international law expert on genocide, said, when you're trying to prove that you didn't give an order to do something, obviously you're going to show orders that indicate something else. And if there's an order to do something or plan to do it, you're not going to provide that. So finally, in its ruling, the ICJ acknowledged Israel's claim that it has taken certain steps to address and alleviate the conditions faced by the population in Gaza. But the court said, while steps such as these are to be encouraged, they're insufficient to remove the risk that irreparable prejudice will be caused before the court issues its final decision in the case. And keep in mind now, Julie, that the court only issued a provisional finding with provisional measures, but the actual case on the merits, where they're going to decide these issues finally, is going to take several years.
Yes, so that's quite a mouthful there, and I will try to follow up with this question. First, we know that the ICJ, as you mentioned, only made interim rulings and did not order an all-out ceasefire. Can you tell our listeners what specifically the provisional measures the ICJ did order and what the vote count was?
Okay, well, first of all, the court concluded that the catastrophic humanitarian situation in Gaza is at serious risk of deteriorating further before the court renders its final judgment on the merits. And the court said the right of the Palestinians to be protected against genocidal acts and the right of South Africa as a party to the Genocide Convention is to ensure Israel's compliance with the convention. And those two rights, the right of the Palestinians and the right of South Africa, can be safeguarded by provisional measures. So the ICJ found a real and imminent risk that irreparable prejudice will be caused to the rights found by the court to be plausible and said it is therefore necessary, pending its final decision, for the court to indicate certain measures in order to protect the rights claimed by South Africa that the court has found to be plausible. So here are the six provisional measures. First, Israel has to take all measures within its power to prevent the commission of genocidal acts, of all genocidal acts. And there are four types of genocidal acts that come right out of the Genocide Convention that the ICJ listed here. First, killing members of the group. Second, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group. Third, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. And fourth, imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group. So that's the first provisional measure, to prevent the commission of all genocidal acts. The second provisional measure that the court ordered is that Israel shall ensure with immediate effect that its military does not commit any genocidal acts. Third, Israel shall take all measures within its power to prevent and punish the direct and public incitement to commit genocide. Fourth, Israel shall take immediate and effective measures to enable the provision of urgently needed basic services and humanitarian assistance. And five, Israel shall take effective measures to prevent the destruction and ensure the preservation of evidence in this case. And finally, Israel shall submit a report to the court about its progress taken to comply with these measures within 1 month. Now, the court also affirmed that all parties to the conflict in the Gaza Strip are bound by international humanitarian law, and it is gravely concerned about the fate of the hostages abducted during the attack in Israel on the 7th of October and held since then by Hamas and other armed groups. And the court called for their immediate and unconditional release. Now, in terms of the votes, there are 15 judges on the International Court of Justice, but since none of them were from Israel or South Africa, each one of those countries was allowed to nominate an ad hoc judge. So there were a total of 17 judges. The votes on the provisional measures were all 15 to 2 or 16 to 1. So the judge from Uganda dissented from all of them. She voted no on all these provisional measures. The Israeli ad hoc judge, Barak, dissented from all the provisional measures except two. One, the measure requiring Israel to prevent and punish incitement to genocide, and the other, to allow humanitarian aid into Gaza.
So among all of these orders that came down from the court, what we know is there was no all-out ceasefire order. That is, it did not order that Israel immediately suspend its military operations despite finding a plausible case for genocide. Isn't that a major omission in these provisional measures that the court ordered?
Well, first of all, it's important to note that the Hamas is not a party to this action because it's not a state party to the Genocide Convention. So the International Court of Justice has no jurisdiction over Hamas at all. And they're not about to argue that Israel stop firing, stop its military action, and not Hamas. So they were actually unable to do that explicitly. But although the court didn't order that Israel immediately suspend its military operations in Gaza, as South Africa had requested, the provisional measures the court did order effectively require a ceasefire. The ICJ's orders forbid the genocidal killing of Palestinians and mandate that Israel allow humanitarian aid into Gaza. Neither of those things can be accomplished without a ceasefire. In fact, South Africa's foreign affairs minister said, "How do you provide aid and water without a ceasefire?" If you read the order, by implication, a ceasefire must happen. So, Julie, even though the ICJ's provisional decision did not explicitly call for a ceasefire, it actually requires one. And in addition, it bolsters the ceasefire campaign around the world and the international pressure in support of Palestinian liberation as it recognizes the fundamental human rights of Palestinians.
So let's talk for a minute, Marjorie, now about enforcement. Is this decision from the ICJ binding? How will it be enforced? And can it be enforced as a practical matter?
Well, Julie, those are great questions. The ICJ, the International Court of Justice, is the highest court in the world. It's the world court. It's the judicial arm of the UN. And its decisions are binding. But the court itself doesn't have enforcement power. Now its decision goes to the UN Security Council for enforcement. Now, we know that the United States consistently provides political and diplomatic cover for Israel by vetoing any substantial criticism of Israel. So I think we can expect the U.S. to veto any enforcement action in the Security Council. And if that happens, the General Assembly, which is the democratic body of the U.N. with 193 countries, all have one vote, they can convene under Uniting for Peace. That's a resolution that was passed by the General Assembly to bypass the Soviet Union's veto during the Korean War. And the General Assembly can recommend that its member states impose arms and trade embargoes, legal, economic, political, diplomatic, consular, and other measures, even organize a military force to intervene in Gaza. The General Assembly could even suspend Israel from the General Assembly. These decisions would require a vote of two-thirds of the 193 member states of the General Assembly, which it is likely to get, judging from prior resolutions the General Assembly has passed about this situation. And then finally, I just wanted to tell you, Julie, what the South African Department of International Relations and Cooperation said in a statement after this ICJ ruling. They said third states are now on notice of the existence of a serious risk of genocide against the Palestinian people in Gaza. They must therefore also act independently and immediately to prevent genocide by Israel and to ensure that they themselves are not in violation of the Genocide Convention, including by aiding and assisting the commission of genocide. And this necessarily imposes an obligation on all states to cease funding and facilitating Israel's military actions, which are plausibly genocidal.
On the flip side of all these enforcement measures, we also know that immediately after the ICJ's ruling, Marjorie, the United States and several of its close allies suspended their funding to the UN Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, in response to Israel's charge that 12 of the 13,000 employees of UNRWA were involved somehow in Hamas's October 7th attacks. Please explain what this means for our listening audience.
Yes, well, Julie, Israel doesn't like UNRWA. They have been gunning for UNRWA for years, and this is uncorroborated information that the U.S. just swallowed hook, line, and sinker, and at least 11 of its allies as well, that 12 staff members of UNRWA were involved in the October 7th attacks. Right after these allegations, UNRWA fired 9 of the suspected offenders. It's investigating the situation. Two of the 12 are dead. One is under investigation. As I said, the U.S. and at least 11 of its allies, which provides 60% of UNRWA's funding, immediately suspended funds to the agency on which nearly all Palestinians in Gaza depend for their survival, including food and shelter. And the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said in a statement, "The abhorrent alleged attacks of these staff members must have consequences, but the tens of thousands of men and women who work for UNRWA, many in some of the most dangerous situations for humanitarian workers, should not be penalized. The dire needs of the desperate populations they serve must be met." Well, Julie, the U.S. leaders' decision to cut humanitarian aid to Gaza to amplify Israel's charges against UNRWA on the very day that the ICJ released its ruling implicitly underscores the message that the U.S. backs Israeli narratives that push for a constant and single-minded return to the attack from Hamas on October 7th, rather than an ongoing accounting of the genocidal campaign Israel has been waging in response ever since.
Shifting to the role of the United States government, can you briefly explain what the U.S. conventional arms transfer policy is and how the Biden administration is violating it with its provision of weapons to Israel, and how, by doing so, the U.S. is furthering Israel's commission of genocide?
Right. Well, Julie, the Biden administration has already been under ongoing scrutiny, both internationally and domestically, just hours after the ICJ announced its landmark ruling, a historic federal court hearing in a lawsuit brought by Palestinians against Joe Biden, Secretary of State Antony Blinken, and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin for failure to prevent genocide and complicity in genocide, was publicly broadcast. And on October 31st, the judge found that there was a plausible case of genocide by Israel against the people in Gaza, the Palestinians, but he dismissed the case, said he didn't have jurisdiction because it involved a political question.
As we've learned, the federal judge in San Francisco specifically relied on and referred to the ICJ ruling that there is indeed a plausible case for genocide being committed against the Palestinian people.
Yes, and of course, we are interviewing one of the lawyers from the Center for Constitutional Rights who brought this case in federal court in Oakland, California, in our next segment. Now, the United States will undoubtedly continue to face international condemnation for its violation of the Genocide Convention, but also, as you mentioned, for violation of its own arms transfer policy in the wake of the ICJ's provisional decision. And the ICJ's ruling also brings into focus how the U.S. government, which provides an annual $3.8 billion to Israel every year and has requested congressional approval for $14 billion more, is actually violating the Biden administration's own U.S. conventional arms transfers policy, which states, "No arms transfer will be authorized where the United States assesses that it's more likely than not that the arms to be transferred will be used by the recipient, that's Israel, to commit, facilitate the recipient's commission of or aggravate risks that the recipient will commit genocide and other international crimes as well." And Biden's policy also says that the assessment of whether Israel's committing, the recipient, is committing human rights violations shall include consideration of the available information and relevant circumstances, including the proposed recipient's current and past actions. Well, as we've said, the ICJ has made extensive factual findings about Israel's conduct in Gaza and cited dehumanizing language by high Israeli officials and statements of alarm by several UN officials. And the ICJ essentially accepted the bulk of South Africa's detailed accusations against Israel. So these findings of the ICJ should serve as a warning to the Biden administration that its continued provision of weapons to Israel would violate both the Genocide Convention and the arms transfer policy.
So, particularly in light of the federal court ruling from January 31st, in which the judge in the United States, despite finding a plausible case for genocide, declined to exercise jurisdiction, what are the political ramifications of the ICJ's decision? How will it affect the global movement and the movement in this country in support of Palestinian liberation?
Yes. Well, Julie, as you know, there have been literally millions of people in the streets all over the world calling for a ceasefire, outraged by what Israel is doing in Gaza to the Palestinian people. And the ICJ ruling has already gone around the world and is bolstering the movement for solidarity with the Palestinian people. It's being used as an organizing tool, and it is also creating and amplifying what we call in international law the mobilization of shame. Israel is shamed in the eyes of the international community, and that is only going to lead to an expansion of the solidarity movement all over the world in favor of the Palestinian people.
Including Jews and non-Jews alike.
Absolutely. Some of the most interesting and impactful actions in the United States have been spearheaded by Jewish Voice for Peace, which is very, very strongly opposed to Israel's occupation, opposed to the Zionist government, and is in solidarity with the Palestinian people. They shut down Grand Central Station, several bridges in major cities around the country. And Jewish Voice for Peace, I'm proud to say I'm a member, has been out there along with other organizations, Jewish and non-Jewish Palestinian organizations, a lot of youth, Palestinian youth movement, have been in the streets as well.
I, too, am an active and proud member of Jewish Voice for Peace. Marjorie, thank you so much for this enlightening and educational explanation of this historic ruling. What do you suggest our listeners can do to make their voices heard about the genocide in Gaza?
Well, one thing that I think has really gotten a so-called shot in the arm from what Israel is doing in Gaza is the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, or BDS. In fact, the Washington Post published an article a week or two ago on the BDS movement. You don't see that penetrating the corporate media. Just briefly, the BDS movement was launched in 2005 when 170 Palestinian civil society organizations called for boycott, divestment, and sanctions, which they characterized as nonviolent punitive measures to last until Israel fully complies with international law. In other words, Israel has to end its occupation and colonization of all Arab territories, dismantle its barrier wall on Palestinian land, recognize the fundamental rights of Israel's Arab-Palestinian citizens to full equality, and respect, protect, and promote the rights of Palestinian refugees to return to their land as mandated by UN General Assembly Resolution 194. Now, the BDS movement has been so successful that when Netanyahu was in the United States a few years back, he called it an existential threat to Israel. And the successes of the BDS movement have prompted Israel lobby organizations, including right-wing Christian Zionist groups, to introduce anti-boycott legislation at the local, state, and federal levels, which violate the First Amendment and this country's long-standing tradition in support of boycotts during the civil rights movement, during the anti-apartheid movement, etc. So I urge people to just type in BDS, boycott, divestment, sanctions, and all kinds of ways to get involved, including a list of the products that are on that in the boycott will come up.
How can our listeners follow your work, Marjorie?
Well, I write generally a weekly column for truthout.org. My column is called Human Rights and Global Wrongs. My writings, videos, all kinds of other work that I've done are all archived on marjoriecohn.com.
Thank you so much, and I look forward to co-hosting with you once more after this interview.
Okay, Julie, I do too, and thanks so much for the great interview.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. On January 26, just hours after the International Court of Justice found a plausible case that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza, a historic 3.5-hour hearing took place in a federal courtroom in Oakland, California. Palestinians who were suing President Joe Biden, Secretary of State Antony Blinken, and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin for failure to prevent genocide and complicity in genocide, testified before District Court Judge Jeffrey White in a live stream session. More than 1,000 people, both in person in the overflow courtroom and via video, watched the hearing. There were also thousands of people outside the courthouse during the hearing, standing in solidarity with the Palestinian plaintiffs. The Center for Constitutional Rights, or CCR, filed the lawsuit on behalf of Palestinian human rights organizations Defense for Children International Palestine and Al-Haq, three Palestinian individuals who live in Gaza, and five Palestinian Americans who have family in Gaza. The plaintiffs petitioned U.S. District Court Judge Jeffrey White to declare that the United States has violated international law and to issue a preliminary injunction to immediately force Biden, Blinken, and Austin to stop providing additional money, weapons, and military and diplomatic support to Israel for its genocide in Gaza. The defendants have asked Congress to appropriate $14.1 billion in military assistance to Israel. That's in addition to the $3.8 billion the U.S. already provides to Israel each year. Blinken authorized a $320 million transfer of military equipment to an Israeli manufacturer of precision bomb kits. On January 31st, Judge White dismissed the case because it involved a, quote, political question, which is reserved to the executive and legislative branches. He wrote that, quote, the ongoing military siege in Gaza is intended to eradicate a whole people and therefore plausibly falls within the international prohibition against genocide. But he concluded that this case was a rare instance where, quote, the preferred outcome is inaccessible to the court. He also wrote that the court implores defendants to examine the results of their unflagging support of the military siege against the Palestinians in Gaza. Maria Lahoud, one of the attorneys who presented the case for the Palestinian plaintiffs, is with us today to discuss the landmark lawsuit and Judge White's order of dismissal. Maria is Deputy Legal Director at CCR, with expertise in constitutional rights and international human rights. Maria works closely with Palestine Legal to support students and others whose speech is being suppressed for their Palestine advocacy around the country. She graduated from the University of Michigan Law School and was named a 2010 Public Justice Trial Lawyer of the Year finalist. Maria Lahoud, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Maria, could you explain who the plaintiffs in this lawsuit are and briefly describe the legal claims that are being made in this case?
Yes, sure. So we have three clients in Gaza. We have Ahmed Abu Artema, who was at his father's house when Israel struck it, killing his 12-year-old son, Mohammed, and his 10-year-old niece and four other relatives. And he and his other family members were severely injured. We also have Dr. Omar al-Najjar, who has been living and working in a hospital day and night, trying to treat the wounded, and also children who have had severe dehydration and infectious diseases. We have another client in Gaza, Mohammed Abu Rakhba, who's a field researcher for Defense for Children International Palestine. And he and his family are now living in a tent in Rafah. His mother's leg was blown off, and he wanted to try to evacuate her just from the north to the south. So DCIP, where he works, called the Red Cross, and they said, we have 10,000 cases like this. There's nothing we can do. We also represent the Palestinian human rights organizations, Defense for Children International Palestine, and Al-Haq. And then we also represent five Palestinian Americans who live in the U.S. but have family in Gaza, and hundreds of their relatives have been killed, and the homes that they knew and the neighborhoods have all been leveled by Israel, and all with their and our tax dollars. So as far as claims, we brought two legal claims under customary international law, which is part of federal common law. First, that the U.S. has violated its duty to prevent genocide, and second, that it's complicit in genocide, including by aiding and abetting it. And that, you know, that customary international law is codified both in the Genocide Convention that the United States ratified and also in federal criminal law.
So, Maria, you are suing Joe Biden, Antony Blinken, and Lloyd Austin for complicity in genocide and failure to prevent genocide, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Right. And Judge White heard the testimony of eight witnesses during the hearing, seven Palestinians and one genocide expert. Could you briefly describe their testimony during the hearing?
Sure. It was extremely powerful. I'm not going to do it justice describing it, so I really encourage people to watch it. It's available online on the court's website, which you can find on CCR's website. You know, many of our clients talked about their relatives who have been killed by Israel's genocide and how that's impacted them. We started the testimony with Dr. Omar al-Najjar, who was calling in from the hospital in Gaza on Zoom, which was something that was incredible to begin with. We didn't even think it would work. He had to go to, you know, stand in the hallway in the hospital outside the administration office so he could get enough Wi-Fi to just stay on to testify. He talked about how there had just been a bombing while he was on the phone waiting, and, you know, he didn't know if his family was okay. And when my co-counsel asked him if he had heard from his sister, he said, "No, but I haven't received her or her children into the hospital." So he hoped that that meant that they were okay. The second person who testified was Ahmed Aboufoul, who works at Al Haq and is also from Gaza. He testified about how his sister had to have a C-section in these conditions and how they're both at serious risk because there's not enough food for her to eat, so she can't breastfeed. Leila El-Haddad talked about her relatives who've been killed and how dehumanizing it is to have her own government unconditionally supporting it, and how, especially when they could just make one phone call and make it stop, and how that's impacted her and her home life and her relationship with her children. Wael El-Bassi talked about how 2 million Palestinians are trapped in a killing field. Manat Al-Hirzala talked about his 4-year-old niece and his cousin, who's like a brother to him, who lost 2 of his sons. His niece had been killed. The children who he considers nephews have been killed. Bassem El-Kara, Israel has killed close to 100 relatives of his. And while we were on break at the hearing, he found out that another cousin had just been killed. Khalid Kuzmar, who is the director of Defense for Children International Palestine, talked about, you know, Mohammed Abu Rakhba and the impact on him, because Mohammed works at DCIP, and how he hasn't been able to work, of course, because he's been dealing with the impact on him and his family of the genocide and has been displaced numerous times and is now living in a tent in Rafah. He talked about how during the 7-day pause, DCIP was able to talk to some children and make videos. And I also suggest people go onto their website and watch the videos, which were just horrifying. One was of a 12-year-old girl, Sonia, who her parents had been killed in a strike. Her siblings had been killed. She had lost a leg, and she was in the hospital, and she did this video, and she was saying how it's her dream that someone, you know, she could go to another country and she could get a prosthetic leg, and she wanted to be a doctor to be able to treat people. And then at the end of the video, you know, the writing comes up, and the hospital she was in was struck and she was killed. So it was really powerful testimony from our clients. We then had our expert, Dr. Barry Trachtenberg, testify, and he's an expert on Jewish studies, Holocaust studies, and genocide studies. And he talked about how we're in such a unique situation right now, watching Israel's genocide unfold, because we can actually do something to stop it. And that is what the whole field of genocide studies and the Genocide Convention is geared toward, is trying to prevent genocide.
Maria, what are the Palestinian plaintiffs alleging in the lawsuit?
So they brought the suit against Biden, Blinken, and Austin, alleging that they are aiding and abetting genocide by providing unconditional support to Israel instead of using their great influence to prevent genocide, as they're legally obligated to do. You know, from the start, U.S. has provided unfettered support with no red lines. It's rushed thousands of bombs and munitions to Israel, knowing they're being used to kill civilians in Gaza. 30,000 about right now. So that's what they're claiming in this case.
Could you tell our listeners, Maria, what you are required to show in order to prove that Biden, Blinken, and Austin are failing to prevent genocide and complicit in genocide?
So for the failure to prevent, there doesn't need to be a finding of genocide. There only needs to be a serious risk that genocide will be committed, and that the defendants aren't taking all reasonably available measures to prevent it. And it matters the great influence that the U.S. has on Israel, because the more influence, the more heightened the duty to prevent is. In order to show that defendants are aiding and abetting Israel's genocide, you need to first show that Israel is committing genocide against the Palestinian people of Gaza. So that requires intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group as such. And then you need genocidal acts, which include killing, causing serious bodily or mental harm, or deliberately inflicting conditions of life calculated to bring about the group's physical destruction in whole or in part. And then to show that the U.S. is aiding and abetting, you need to just show that the defendants have knowingly provided assistance to Israel that has a substantial effect on Israel's genocide.
And Maria, what were you specifically asking Judge White to do?
So we were asking here for declaratory and injunctive relief. We were asking the court to declare that defendants violated their duty to prevent Israel from committing genocide, and that the duty prohibits their complicity in genocide, aiding and abetting it. So given those duties, the court must at a bare minimum order defendants to stop providing support to Israel, to stop providing the weapons that Israel is using to commit genocide.
Did Judge White appear sympathetic to what the plaintiffs and their families and organizations have endured, Maria?
Absolutely. In fact, I would say he didn't just appear sympathetic, he was sympathetic. He clearly felt and understood the gravity of the case before him. He was so attentive to our client's testimony. He said it was the most difficult case, factually and legally, that he's ever had. He thanked each of the plaintiffs for what he called gut-wrenching testimony. He was clearly troubled also by the lack of recourse elsewhere, but unfortunately not troubled enough.
During the hearing, Judge White noted that the government did not dispute the uncontradicted evidence of a, quote, genocide in progress. But the judge was concerned about the political question doctrine. Can you explain what that is, please?
Yeah, the political question doctrine comes from the constitutional separation of powers. So the Constitution lays out the roles of the three branches of our government. The executive power is vested in the president, legislative power is vested in Congress, and judicial power is vested in the courts. And political questions are for the political branches, and legal questions are for the judiciary to decide. So unfortunately, the doctrine has sometimes been warped to say that any issue implicating foreign affairs or foreign policy should be left to the executive branch, although there's clear precedent that that's not the case, that just because those foreign affairs issues are implicated, it doesn't make it a political question. And although actual political questions may be for the political branches, it's the judiciary's role to adjudicate legal disputes, to apply the law to facts and determine and uphold the law to resolve cases and controversies under the Constitution. So otherwise, it's a doctrine of impunity for the executive and a doctrine of deference to the executive. And the judiciary is abdicating its constitutional role to check executive power and adjudicate disputes.
My co-host Heidi Boghossian and I, Marjorie Cohn, are speaking to Maria LaHood from the Center for Constitutional Rights about their lawsuit against Joe Biden and his Secretaries of State and Defense. Maria, could you please discuss Judge White's dismissal of your lawsuit and what was his reasoning?
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned at the top some of the great language in the judge's decision, basically finding that it's plausible that Israel is committing a genocide and imploring the U.S. to examine the result of its unflagging support for the genocide. But in the end, he dismissed it on political question grounds. He said the preferred outcome would have been not to, but he felt constrained by this doctrine. He interpreted plaintiff's claims as challenging the appropriateness of providing financial and military aid to Israel, and that's challenging the executive branch officials' conduct of foreign affairs, and that here Congress and the president have determined that military and economic assistance to Israel is necessary. But plaintiffs aren't asking the court to assess their political decisions. They're asking the court to uphold binding legal obligations, to determine the legality of their conduct, not to judge the wisdom of discretionary policy choices. It's not within the executive's discretion to aid and abet genocide. That's a clear violation of the law. We have federal criminal law banning it. We have ratification of a treaty banning it. We have customary international law obligations that are part of our federal common law that make it illegal. And it's the judge's role to adjudicate and uphold the law.
Maria, do you plan to file an appeal of Judge White's decision?
You know, it's early. We still need to discuss it with our clients, but an appeal to the Ninth Circuit would be the next step.
Now, even though Judge White dismissed your case, Maria, how does this case still serve an important role in the struggle against genocide in Gaza?
Well, you know, like I mentioned, finding that Israel is plausibly committing genocide and imploring the U.S. to stop, essentially, that part of the decision can really be used to pressure our elected officials to stop this genocide, and they should be used. It is, you know, even more notice that we had before that the U.S. executive's obligation to prevent a genocide is in effect and has been in effect, and that they need to uphold their legal obligation even if the court isn't going to force them to. We also have, you know, Palestinians testified about the genocide being committed against them with U.S. complicity and about the Nakba in a U.S. court, and that's available online for everyone to see forever. You know, they're challenging power, and they have created a historical record. And I think all of us can use the opinion and the testimony as advocates to pressure policymakers and especially the Biden administration to stop aiding and abetting this genocide.
Well, Maria, to dovetail with that, what can our listeners do to demonstrate solidarity with the Palestinian people now?
I'll suggest, again, watching our client's testimony online and spreading the word about their stories and amplifying the demands of the case. You know, the judge said it's every individual's obligation to confront the current siege in Gaza. Each of us is paying for the weapons that are killing Palestinian children, and so we all need to demand that our government stop now. We need to speak out. We need to get out in the streets and protest and write and call our representatives and other government officials. We need to engage in BDS. You know, there are weapons companies. There's complicity everywhere, and we need to stop it everywhere. So, yeah, doing everything we can to stop complicity in the genocide.
And Maria, when you say BDS, you mean the boycott, divestment, and sanctions.
Yes, thank you. Boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Yes.
Yes. Well, we're coming to the end of our allotted time. How can people follow your important work, Maria?
If you go to our website, ccrjustice.org, you can find our case page with all the filings. You can also sign up for email updates there. If you want to follow us on social media, you can follow us on Instagram at ccrjustice or on X, formerly Twitter, at the CCR, and you can follow what we're doing.
Well, Maria, thank you so much for being with us and explaining to our listeners this really, really path-breaking case that you brought, and hopefully it's not over.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thanks for your support.
Thanks, Maria. Take care. We'll talk soon.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.